Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Cosmos Magazine Summer 2018. It makes me really suspicious that I've written Winter 2018 on all the software. I can't remember. This is one of the memory things. I'm doing cardiac rehab, where I'm trying to read for a long period of time. So I started off at 15 minutes, got up to 20, 30, 40 minutes, where I get to go. And I'm trying to improve my memory of things. So I'll do a podcast, and then, as happened, I had to take my son off to AFL footy. His team didn't win, unfortunately, so his team came third in the competition. It was an elimination grand final. But the point of that is that I came back and had to remember what I'd read a few hours earlier. And so there's just pushing along, and there's things I say, oh, look, I have to really read, research things. So it's really testing my memory, which is great. So, Some Infinite, this is by Paul Davis, a theoretical physicist, cosmologist, astrobiologist, and best-selling author. What else could you ask for? Some infinities are bigger than others. Few numbers have exercised more fascination and confusion than infinity. I can remember asking my father at a young age whether space went forever. He replied that it must so, because however far you travelled in space, you could always stretch your arm into another void beyond. Same thing with time. It will go on for all eternity, and it does stretch back infinitely far into the past. No, it doesn't. Philosophers and scientists have wrestled with the question throughout the ages, but most of the time, infinity is a concept. It's not well defined. Now, that's really interesting. That really fascinated a lot of the mathematicians, even right down to the atomists, and that I've got to remember, it's Pythagoras, the monotheist, the monad, the circle and the dot. Consider the natural numbers 1, 2, 3 and so on. They could go on without limit. There is infinity of natural numbers. I wonder if we're going to go transinfinite. Now ask if there's more natural numbers than even numbers. After all, even numbers are 2, 4, 6 and so on. It contains within the natural numbers interspersed with the odd ones. But then you've got the correspondence, a one-to-one ratio. Now, which is to do with set theory. It is tempting to say there's twice as many natural numbers as even numbers, but that's wrong. Well, it's not necessarily wrong, it's just not the correct question when you're looking at it. I really dislike it when people say, look, you're wrong. You know, you are right. In any given set, there's twice as many natural numbers as even numbers, but in terms of the counting set members, one-to-one correspondence of a set. So an infinite set has infinite sets within it. Okay, when we say two sets of objects are equal, we put them in a correspondence of one-to-one basis. For example, if I claim I have the same number of fingers as toes, I mean for every finger there's one corresponding one toe. No toes left over, no fingers unmatched at the finish. Now do the same for natural numbers. 1 to 2, 2 to 4, 3 to 6 and so on. There'll be exactly one even number for every natural number. In fact, such theories form an infinite set means that sets of numbers are the same size, even though one set is contained within another. This result gives a definition of infinity. An infinite set is an object so big that it isn't made any bigger by adding to it or doubling it, nor is it made any smaller by subtracting from it or halving it. Now, this is going to be interesting if he gets to... Oh, yes, okay, there you go. It is a paradox made famous by German mathematician David Hilbert, who, in a lecture delivered in 1924, envisaged a hotel with an infinite number of rooms. Even when the hotel is full, he pointed out, you can still accommodate a new guest if every guest vacates their room and moves one along, thus freeing up the room, room number one. This can be done an infinite number of times. This is not quite transinfinite yet. In spite of this, it would be wrong to think the infinity of natural numbers, which mathematicians refer to as countable infinite set, because you can count members one by one as the biggest conceivable number. But I think he's actually going to miss out on transinfinite. he hasn't got the, it's interesting. Between, so, guys, so if you have a set of all numbers plus the set of numbers which enumerate all those numbers, you have a set which is bigger than the conceived set, countable set. Okay, in between 1 and 2, there lies an infinite number of numbers, such as 3/5, some other fraction. There's no limit to how many digits can hold the numerator and denominator fractions, so they're real numbers, non-algebraic numbers, or transcendental. Nevertheless, it wouldn't surprise you to learn that the set of all fractions is, in fact, no bigger than the set of all natural numbers. They form countably infinite sets, too. But not all numbers between 1 and 2 are fractions. Some decimals with infinite numbers of digits after the point cannot be expressed as fancy as their transcendental numbers, I believe. For example, the square root of 2, well, that's an algebraic number, not a transcendental number. It's known as an irrational number because it cannot be expressed as a ratio of two integers. This is what Descartes, the best is understood by envisaging a continuous number by equal numbers of natural numbers 1 to 2, and so on. There'll be an infinite number of points between 1 and 2, for example, each point corresponding to a decimal number. No matter how many small an interval on that line and how much you magnify it, there'll always be an infinite number of points corresponding to an infinite number of decimals. It turns out the set of points on a continuous line is a bigger infinity than in natural numbers. Yeah, okay, well, that's a bit misleading the way it's put. Mathematicians, there are uncountably infinite numbers of points in a line in a three-dimensional space and in a three-dimensional space. You simply can't match up each point on a line with natural numbers and one-to-one correspondence. So there are two types of infinity. One that, and it doesn't stop there. But I will. I have been allocated a finite number of words, column. Let me finish by returning to my father's answer about space. Is it infinite? Well, yes and no. If it is continuous, and some physicists think it may be, then it will contain an uncountably infinite number of points. But that doesn't mean it goes on forever. As Einstein discovered, it may be curved in and of itself to form infinite volume. Oh, I think this has really gone bad because mathematics is the exploration of the number of theorems you can generate from a set of Euclidean, what they called, axioms. So, for a given set of axioms, you want to see the maximum number of theorems. So it's internal, got nothing to do with, you can have maths without space. But here is, science is an explanation of nature. This led him to remark, only two things are infinite, the universe and human stupidity. I'm not sure about the former. Okay, well, I think that's actually missed some really interesting things about trans-infinite numbers there. Okay, now we're going to read through here. A conversation starter. It's a book. And I mightn't do too many books. I just quickly have one. This is about bees, and I love bees. And the book is Bee Quest by David Golson. Why should nature have only worth only if it does something for us? Just show us, just how self-obsessed are we? In any case, this approach fails flat in the face when we are presented with a corn cake or great yellow bumblebee. Recent studies suggest that most pollination is delivered by just 2% of the bee species in an area. The common ones, as you might guess, economically, great yellow bumblebees are utterly inconsequential. They probably contribute a tiny bit to pollination of a few garden vegetables on the crofts of the U-list. Its truth is neither corn cakes or great bumblebees nor great many other plants or animals contribute anything meaningful to the ecosystem surfaces. We would not be noticeable any worse off with any easily measurable way if they were one day to shuffle off. But I, for one, would consider that a very sad day indeed. I don't know, it's just a quote for some reason. I'm going to skip through book reviews because they're just a bit hard to get through. Non-fiction, book review. So much more to this. More book reviews. And, of course, more book reviews, which beautifully good that they're actually reading all three of these books, these guys. Okay, Destination. So there's a picture of a, there's really famous things, anatomical drawings where they actually inject resin in and make real skulls. Okay, Musée Fragonard Lafort, Maison Lafort, France. It's a museum we're going to talk about. And of course, I'm trying to get up to 40 minutes and get through this thing. Play School. For several decades now, German autonomist Gunther von Harkens, which has enjoyed success or perhaps notoriety through his Body Worlds expedition featuring real cadavers stripped and muscles layers encoded with plastic. And yeah, I was going to show that at school, but then they said to stop, it's too ghoulish. Almost, which is part of the standard thing, you get everything signed off, and all professionally done. Almost 250 years ago, under another anatomist, Honoré Fragonard, pioneered the concept of posing real skinned bodies in precise intersection of ghoulish fascination and scientific interest. In 1766, Fragonard was appointed professor of anatomy at École Naturelle Vétérinaire de Maison Lafort, southeast of Paris, quickly set about creating a bizarre collection of tableaux featuring flayed corpses. He created some 700 exhibits before being dismissed from his position in 1771 on suspicion of being insane. Only 21 remain today, including Albert Durutsch's inspired man on horseback, surrounded by dancing fetuses, more human fetuses having a dance. And a dead bloke holding a jawbone in apparent emulation of the biblical figure Samson. The creations form some of the display of the eponymous Musée Fragonard de Lafort in the Paris suburb of Maison Lafort. Oh, I'll have to really see that. That's a great thing. Other attractions include preserved co-joined twins lambs, calf with two heads, and dissected pig. Entry requires small admission fee and a strong stomach. I must admit, there are fantastic things when I go back to Paris. There's the Pantheon with the Foucault pendulum. You know, sort of things I'd like to go and see that. Okay, this is Artifact, page 107. Sign, S-I-N-E, of the time. Ah. No, I don't quite understand. It's a watch with various numbers on it. There is a certain kind of joke that relies on a smart reference and a groan-inducing pun or innuendo. Think, I used to be a structuralist, but now I'm a Saussure. A string theorist do it in 11 dimensions. Oh, God. It has a shape of a joke, but really it's about being enough in the know to get it. When you laugh, you're saying, yes, of course, I know that Ferdinand de Saussure was the father of structural linguistics. And, of course, I'm familiar with Stephen Hawking's, as it's called, the only candidate for complete theory of the universe. What kind of fool would know that? That's the idea, presumably, behind a mathematician's watch. The familiar numbers of the face of the watch have been replaced with a mathematical formula. Instead of 1, for instance, with a tan of 45, instead of 2, there's a square root of 4. Okay. The problem is whoever designed it forgot the jokes. What left is excessively quietly announces the wearer's familiarity with the arithmetic, and perhaps more telling, loudly announces the wearer's desire to know as geeky and nerdy. You might have a grudging respect for someone who knows the log of 55 is approximately 4, since memorizing the logarithms went out of style with the invention of the slide rule in the 1620s, I think, or 1620. I must admit, I do love slide rules. I really, really love slide rules because you've got the fact that you can add logs together, add and subtract them is such a fantastic thing. And, of course, it's countable. You know, it's one of those things with stuff. There's someone who thinks that it is a cachet to knowing that 3 times 3 equals 9. Oh, there you go. The question arises, who would buy it? A kid who skipped a couple of grades and wears a bow tie? Someone tired of giving socks to their emotionally distant engineer fire? Don't do it, folks. He'll complain about the capital pi in the formula for 3. Oh, God. And a system rounding G up to 10 is a recipe for disaster even with simple real-world calculations. There's also a possibility your correspondent simply doesn't get it. While most of the formula are clear enough, the replacement for 11 is a stumper. There you go. There's 11, I don't know. I must admit, suggestions or explanations welcome, Michael. What I must say is, oh, I might send it off to you, Michael, but one of the things I must say is that the square root of 10 is very close to pi, or pi squared is very close to 10. And this is something well worth looking at. So they have a periodic table, and as you know, I love the periodic table. And they've got the periodic table in colours. And in red, it shows if it's been in the Big Bang, and that shows hydrogen, helium, and a bit of lithium. And it shows also blue is in massive stars, or dying low-mass stars. Oh, yeah, okay. So what they have done is different colours across. Yep. And then they show blue comes from massive stars, exploding white dwarfs, and a beautiful, isn't that fantastic, phosphorus silicon, chlorine argon going through. Chromium comes mostly from the stars, and yet the merging neutron stars create just a massive number of elements. Isn't that incredible? So almost from strontium, yttrium, zirconium, niobium, molybdenum, technetium, ruthenium, rhodium, gold, cadmium, indium, zinc, antimony, tellurium, iodine, xenon, goes forward. And it's just the periodic table. Beautiful view. In a galaxy 130 million light years away, two neutron stars were caught in a fatal embrace. They were remnants of exploded stars only 20 kilometers wide, so dense the deceased itself would have weighed as Mount Everest, each little heavier than the sun and spinning 1,000 times a second like a great pair of kitchen blends. They churned up space-time as they drew close together, descending into gravitational waves rippling through space. This situation is not uncommon. The universe is studded with pairs of dangerously attracted neutron stars, eventually whirling almost as fast as light itself. Our pair surrendered to the gravity and collided. I love that, surrendered to gravity. God, what are they talking about? An immense shockwave radiated out into the universe. Only 130 million years later, it reached Earth. Astronomers had long predicted that such collisions would be commonplace, occurring somewhere about once every second. But this was the first they were able to catch in the act. At 12:41 Universal Time on the 17th of August 2017, three gravitational wave detectors, isn't that great, three wave detectors, on planet Earth picked up the shockwave. It sounded like a chirp. Over the course of 100 seconds, its frequency climbed to 1,000 cycles per second, supernova hard C, as predicted, crescendos of a neutron star's collision. Okay. Two of the detectors are located 3,000 kilometers apart in opposite corners of the US belong to the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observer, GLICO. The third was Virgo, a detector in Italy. Isn't that great for you Italians? About 1.7 seconds after the alert went off at LIGO, Virgo, the Fermi Space Telescope detected a short burst of intense gamma rays coming from the same part of the sky. Researchers believe the gamma ray bursts, like those that caused neutron star, were also caused by neutron star collisions. Now, also, I don't know if you've seen space telescopes, the way that they can turn with just the most eerie space accuracy. They can actually turn, and because everything's computer controlled, they can actually turn from angle to angle like a sharpshooter. You just couldn't ask for it, but this is tons of spacecraft. Using all three gravitational waves detectors as gamma rays flash, astronomers were able to triangulate the source of the shockwave to a 30-degree arc of the southern sky. That's actually quite big. In the vicinity of Hydra constellation, as dusk fell in Chile, a team from the University of California, Santa Cruz, started scanning the sky with a 1-meter SWOPE telescope. About 10 hours later, they found something suspicious in a galaxy called NGC 4993, a new dot of bluish light that faded, turned red, and disappeared over the course of several days. What the astronomers saw was a killer nova, intense light radiating from a halo of material that exploded out from the neutron star collisions. I love the idea of a new thing. Thank you very much, Cosmos Magazine. I didn't know about killer novas before that, a new supernova. Modelling by Brian Mitzer of Columbia University suggested the emissions at different colours of light are the signatures of heavy atoms being flung into space. The first few days, the glow was bluish, corresponding to the formation of lighter, heavy elements. The following days, the glow became reddish and signature of the heaviest elements like gold and platinum. Physicists are ecstatic about their observations and confirmed long-standing theories that neutron star collisions are the source of most of the bling in the universe. Isn't that absolutely amazing? Isn't that amazing? Okay, that's a new thing for me. I was trying to work out how a standard supernova could possibly get a neutron flux sufficient to make things up like uranium. Isn't that insane? Metzger estimates the amount of gold created by a particular collision was about 400 to 100 times the mass of Earth. Gold and platinum symbols underlying passion turn out to have been flinged in the consuming passion of neutron stars. Oh, that's a nice article. And beautiful, beautiful periodic table. You'll have to go and buy Cosmos Magazine. And we're up to 21 minutes. Head to scientists do battle. Top 6. Science is a lively business, and scientists sometimes disagree vehemently. Stephen Fleischer calls 6 of the biggest scientific fights in history. Okay. Oh, the philosopher John. Okay, numerando of calculus. Isaac Newton, born in 1643, and perhaps the most celebrated scientist of all time. He's also a notorious, terrible teacher who gave few lectures to empty rooms at Cambridge, spent a large part of his life in Candleston, alchemist, and wrote more about religion and science. Well, that sums him up. And he didn't write about his own science very well. He must have used calculus for that. When he first demonstrated the use of calculus, he did so in an offhand manner. He didn't bother to explain it for another 20 years, which is exactly right. So, by the time he had published it, nearly 30 years later, Gottfried William Leibniz of Germany widely published his own system. While the two men acknowledged each other's work, anachronistic debate about who first devised calculus ensued, mostly driven by their supporters. The English-speaking world favoured Newton's, continental Leibniz. They're both nutcases. I'm going to have to read up Leibniz. Until evidence came to light, he had altered documents to support his claim. Oh, Leibniz. Oh. Newton, on the other hand, provided little or no proof of his claim other than his say-so. Well, that's exactly right, isn't it? I really hate people who alter documents. That just is the worst thing. It's an insult. For all those bitterness, modern historians agree that two most likely came up to calculus independently. Phlogiston versus oxygen, number 2. Antoine Laurent Lavoisier, born in France in 1743, is the father of modern chemistry. He was not, however, the father of fizzy drinks, which is the oxygen is Priestley. Oh, there you go. The honour goes to the contemporary Joseph Priestley. Priestley, born in England in 1733, invented soda water as a result of experience of gases as he put different kinds of air. His experiments, which included asphyxiating mice, yeah, that's right, But you know, if you want to know how we do, we'll see if he explains it. Did not free him from his famous beliefs in phlogiston, a substance conjectured in the 17th century to be released in the air during combustion. So how he didn't asphyxiate mouse, he discovered oxygen by keeping a mouse alive in a bell jar by putting it in mercury oxide and heating it with a magnifying glass. He famously claimed to have experimentally produced deflagellated air, which could be absorbed through phlogiston and thus encouraged combustion. I don't think the Priestley and Lavoisier, they visited each other. I don't think they really conflicted all that much. Okay, but I'll read it. In 1774, Priestley demonstrated this to Lavoisier, who initially impressed by the results and ultimately rejected this phlogiston nonsense. He called Priestley's deflagellated air oxygen, arguing it was a burning substance that absorbed oxygen from the air rather than producing phlogiston. Priestley refused to accept this despite ample evidence. His refusal led to his isolation of the scientific community and his unfortunate moniker of Dr. Phlogiston. Oh, okay. I think Priestley went to the United States, I'm pretty sure. Which is, I mean, he was also rejected by the English establishment because he was not of the Church of England, a priest of the not of the Church of England. So, I don't know, it's a bit... Three, a biological structure and function. One of the first chapters in a truly modern biology featured a feud between French comparative... Etienne Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire and Georges Calivier. In 1793, at the age of 22, Geoffroy made a professor of zoology at the Museum National History Naturelle de Paris. Now this is where it's reading up. Who was it? Lamarck. I was reading about Lamarck in this. He was soon hired another wonderkind, Cuvelier. They worked together in most of their lives and got along famously until Cuvelier was admitted to the Académie des Sciences in honor extend to Geoffroy for another 12 years. This triggered a falling out, both personal and scientific. The main bone of contention was an actual bone called the hyoid. In howler monkeys, this another primates, it's located at the base of the jaw. Cuvelier believed God gave monkeys a hyoid just the right shape to enable them to howl. Geoffroy thought that the monkey hyoid had adapted to facilitate howling. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, and the most contemporary observers declare Cuvelier's position right. Probably because he was an expert networker. Now, Geoffroy is recognised as the more important precursor to evolutionary thinking. Now, we'll probably have to reread that Lamarck book because it was a whole lot of things. And Cuvelier was with Lamarck. I can't quite remember what it is. So it was gradualism. Believed in gradualism and cataclysm, something like that. Four, the existence of atoms. Now, this is a good one. Because most people in the atomic theory began with the ancient Greek philosopher Democritus and Lysippus, we tend to overlook how contested the idea was until the early 20th century. Ludwig Boltzmann, I hope they do his suicide, born in 1844, was an Austrian physicist famous for explaining how the properties of atoms led to the macroscale properties of matter. Although his work was now considered seminal in thermodynamics, he faced fierce opposition by the physicists William Ostwald and Ernst Mach. Is that the correct spelling of Mach? M-A-C-H. That's strange. Who viewed atoms as nothing more than theoretical constructs, and throughout the time and thought it was time to replace the old atomic mechanistic world picture. In 1904, the conference attended by many big-name physicists of the day, including Boltzmann and his anti-atom nemesis, there was a feeling that Ostwald and Mach won the day, having the atom out of the outs. Boltzmann hanged himself the year. It's 1906. And what we would know about Call bipolar disorder. But some speculate his suicide was related to his treatment of atomic theory, and I think it definitely was. There's this story, at least a contemporary story, of American physicists trying to get through Trieste and get to him in time to tell him about Einstein's breakthrough. Historian Stephen Bush ranks his suicide as one of the greatest tragedies of the history of science. Yeah, especially since Mark was actually a psychopathic bully to him. Ernst Mach bullied and cajoled him and just destroyed him. It was just awful. And this is all covered up. Continental drift. Wigner. Ah, yes. While science has based on rough and tumble of peer review, contests of ideas, Alfred Wigner could have been forgiven for feeling a bit persecuted. Just when he was, poor bastard. I don't know. I hope they do. Been stuck on a glacier in Greenland. The German born in 1880 was a meteorologist, polar researcher, and sometimes geologist who became intrigued by the similarity between fossils on either side of the Atlantic and the way the shapes of the continents appear to work together. In 1915, he put forward a new theory arguing the continents could have been once joined together in one massive landmass. He called it continental Abwärtsschwingung. We call it continental drift. At the time, many scientists ignored this fanciful theory. One group took things even further after reading a poorly translated edition of Wigner's work that made him sound a bit too impertious for their liking. The American Association of Petroleum Geologists organized an entire conference for the sole purpose of rubbishing his theory. Nonetheless, the German was eventually vindicated and his work became the basis of the current scientific consensus on plate tectonics. Oh, a bit rough there. But I do actually know American geologists still in the, I suppose, 70s were still, you know, hating it and really wishing it was differently. Those who were in Michigan and stuff like that. The politics of social biology is 6. The superheated feud between American biologist Edward O. Wilson and Richard Lewontin in the 70s was made worse by Lewontin's office being directly above Wilson's. Both worked in Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology. Wilson was a curator of entomology and is famous for his work on ants. Lewontin was a professor of biology, a population geneticist speculating in the application of game theory to evolution. That's, I love that. When put forward the theory of sociobiology, which he defined as a systematic study of biological basis on all social behavior, the theory was poorly received by some, as it seemed to imply biological justification for certain political arrangements and social inequalities. Leibniz, whose views were influenced by Marxism, went to town Wilson's ideas in every form he could find, slamming the theory as racist, sexist, and capitalist. Wilson simply noted that the Marxism was a wonderful theory, wrong species. Oh, that's quite funny. That's quite funny. Implying communism might work fine for ants, but not for humans. That just made Lewison madder. That's quite funny. Okay.
How are we going? 33 minutes. God.
Debunked. Can bananas kill you? On the internet, there has been a subset of websites called mum blogs, or more often mommy blogs, written by people convinced the condition of being a parent invests with them the wisdom not usually available to others. For the most part, these blogs are harmless enough and sometimes entertaining, But it is not, as a rule, a good idea to accept everything within them as critically. Sometimes, sad to say, mothers don't know best. Occasionally, the subject of bananas arise, as they do. All too often, a curious fear about them surfaces. Quote, so here is the warning, quote, writes one posted on a site called Mumset. Quote, eating too many bananas can lead to banana poisoning. Fact. Is it? The fear of bananas can kill a surprisingly resilient one. The fear that bananas can kill is aspiring. It takes two forms. They can give you fatal overdose of potassium or a deadly dose of radiation. On the first matter, it is well known that bananas contain potassium, and this is a good thing. Mothers, most of them anyway, often tell their kids to chow down on one precisely for that reason. Human digestive system loves potassium. There is a limit, however. Too much potassium leads sometimes to fatal conditions called hyperkalemia. It can be caused by kidney failure, heavy drinking, low red blood cells counts, or stuffing your face with potassium supplements. British comedian Carl Pilkington once suggested that fatal levels of potassium accrue from the human body if a person eats seven or more bananas in one sitting, which is why supermarkets only sell them in bunches of six. Sadly, some people don't get that it was a joke. The average banana came about 420 milligrams, so that's quite a lot, of potassium. Health authorities recommend a daily allowance of 10 times that much, i.e. 11 bananas. Estimates the amount of potassium needed to induce hyperkalemia vary widely because much of it depends on the individual's weight, general health, but several put the safer limit as 18 grams a day, or approximately 42 bananas. About 95% of potassium ingested gets sent out again pretty quickly by the kidneys, so to those, 42 fruits would need to be eaten in a short period of time to make someone sick. Sure, bananas are very yummy, but 3.5 dozen a day. What about radiation fear? Bananas are radioactive? Yes, they actually. And it's interesting that potassium-40 radiation gives you argon. Didn't know that. So all the argon, 1% of our atmosphere, is bananas. Well, not really. Eating bananas exposes you to equivalent of roughly 1% of your average daily exposure to background radiation. In 1995, Gary Marshall, a scientist in Lawrence Livermore Laboratory in the US, used the information to formulate what he called the banana equivalence dose, or the BED. Daily average background exposure is 1,000 BEDs. So will the fondness of bananas, even a passion for them, that pushes you above the Carlton 6 and bunch limit give you radiation sickness? No, a lethal dose of radiation experienced by probably 3,500 milliserverts for our purposes can be rendered by 35 million beds. The chance of eating 35 million bananas are perhaps, we can agree on, a little remote. Go tell your mum. That's really awful, that one. Who wrote that one? Andrew Masterson. You have to be careful, mate. Inspiring sci-fi by the same author. Star Wars tragic solar sails. Star Wars tragics will, of course, be aware that solar sails are deployed on several spacecraft in George Lucas's fictional universe. It appears, for instance, the Givnex-class starfighters and the Jet-class sail yachts. And who could forget Count Dooku's pimped-up Walker 116-class interstellar sloop, which escaped from the first battle of Genoas? I couldn't. Okay, most people don't delve into sci-fi movies quite that deeply, but Lucas's love of solar sails as a method to propel spacecraft is no mere figment of the imagination. Okay, I have to get in and cook tea pretty soon. So how am I doing? 39 minutes, I'll be able to get up to my 40 minutes limit. Solar sails, I say, okay. Solar sails use the sun for propulsion, explains David Siegel Bernstein in his 2017 book, Blockbuster Science, The Real Science in Science Fiction, Prometheus Books. Photons shooting from a star carry energy and momentum. The energy is HF, and the momentum is H on lambda. So, in high frequency is the momentum. A solar sail captures the momentum and reflects it off, resulting in continuous acceleration. It was pioneering astronomer Johann Kepler who suggested the best part of four centuries ago that comet tails were created by breezes, that therefore the ship and sails proper of the heavenly air should be fashioned. James Clerk Maxwell demonstrated this, that such sails could be propelled not by wind but by the pressure of photons bouncing off the surface. NASA proved the principle out of necessity in the 1974 when the Mariner 9 10 spacecraft ran out of fuel. The mission controlled angle of the craft so it caught and hit its flat panel arrays, giving the photon boost it needed to keep moving. Wow! Gosh, Mariner 10, I'll have to look that one up. Since the several organizations have experimented with solar sails, one challenges in doing so is the technology, although very simple in one respect, is extremely difficult to test on Earth. Solar sails only work beyond the planet's atmosphere, where the particle-filled winds created by the sun blow unfettered. That's different solar wind and photons. Even when all the technical problems are ironed out, therefore, you will never see a craft powered by solar sails taking off from Cape Canaveral. They must rely on some form of rocket propellant to get them out there of the atmosphere before the sails can be unfurled, or dock near Earth orbits and have their passengers ferried on them by a smaller feeder craft. Work continues. Space, however, because of solar sails, once fully developed, will offer a low-cost, renewable, fuel-free way to travel through space. Oh, it's a dubious article here. We're going up to 41 minutes. Okay. Dali's favourite mathematician, René Thom. This is always like these articles. And this is by Andrew Maston. Good on him, Andy. Okay, not so long ago, academic engineer Alan McRow visited a museum of in Figueres, Spain, dedicated to Salvador Dali, and entered a private library untouched since the famous surrealist death in 1989. On the table sat a book called Parables et Catastrophe, a French mathematician by René Thom. It contained a handwritten dedication, Thom to Dali, addressed as the master, dedicated in 1983. Opening it, Roby found drawings of several pages, mostly line sketches of nudes. One depicted a naked person, arms aloft, leaping for joy. It was McRoby speculates perhaps the last drawing Dali ever did. If so, it was particularly appropriate for both the artist and the mathematician. Dali was born in 1904, a member of the Spanish aristocracy. Thom, T-H-O-M, was born in 1923, a French town of Montreuil-Bellard, a son of shopkeepers. The mathematician would heavily influence Dali's final decade. The artist co-opted equations and symbols from Thom's books, used his terminology, and even named the painting Topological Detachment of Europe. Homage to René Thom. The pair worked in very different spheres. Both were mavericks, loved by many, scorned by others, recognized as polymaths who refused to be constrained to the boundaries of their disciplines. The word sphere is rather apt. Thom's best known achievements start with geometry of curved surfaces, a deceptively simple sounding topic that brief investigation quickly reveals is eye-wateringly complicated. Fame came early to Thom. He went to school at the University of Paris. At the later, he completed the PhD thesis called Fibra fibrous spaces in spheres and steroid squares. The ideas explored within led 7 years later to him being awarded the Fields Medal, the premier prize for mathematics. In 1968, he completed his second work, Structural Stability and Morphogenesis, in which he established what's called catastrophe theory, which describes how dynamical systems undergo sudden change. Love that. Large-scale changes because of tiny shifts in initial conditions. The text is pretty much impossible for anyone except mathematician theorists to comprehend. Went far beyond geometry. Thomas Hume uses theory to explain not just curves, but also language, embryo growth, and even shapes of genitals. He continued to explore even strange applications, military organization, for instance. He invented semiophysics, which combined mathematicians and sign-based analysis of language known as semiotics. Meanwhile, catastrophe theory developed a life of its own. American mathematician Stephen Small recast it on the basis of his own work, known as chaos theory. It also became the stuff of pop science. It was incorporated into books, prison riots, and dogfights. It became popular with psychoanalysts and lauded by the French philosopher Jean-François Lyotard, who dubbed it as postmodern science. Jean-Luc Godard made a film about Tom, which contributed to making him a controversial character in the conservative world of mathematics. It was a role he rather liked. His output remained prodigious. McRobe notes, there is a Tom space, a Tom isomorphism, a Tom class, a Tom transversality theorem, and a Dodd-Tom theorem, and the Tom Portunus formula, and the Tom conjecture. It's perhaps not surprising that Daly, who often used science and mathematics in his work, asked to meet Thom. The artist's later works are full of catastrophe theory, the word topology, the broader maths field which the theory relies, crops up in many of Daly's works. Geometric shapes based on curves intersecting sharp angles and swallowtails overlay many of his paintings. Daly's last acknowledged public painting, Swallowtail and Cello Catastrophe Series, is pure Thom. The drawings of Daly's copy in Paroxe de Catastrophes were likely done even later in his final months. McRode remarks that they are, quote, remarkable because Thom makes no mention of the connection between catastrophe theory and life drawing. Indeed, it fell to McRode himself to do that. His book, Relating Thom's Mathematics to Shapes of the Nude Bodies in Art, Seduction of Curves, was published by Princeton Press in 2017. Now, Thom died in 2002. His influence, however, seems to continue, like Dahl's, for quite a while yet. And I think that ends my reading. There's one more book I've reached my 47 minutes reading, and that really ends my reading of Cosmos Magazine. Thanks for listening. Thanks for joining me. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.